Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, May 17th, 2005, with a special edition during the WBAI Fun Drive. We have for you today an incredible premium. Some of you may have heard parts of Who Killed Kennedy and Why. And it's a two-CD lecture that Ralph gave. It's a historic lecture, and it is finally edited by Bonnie Faulkner of the KPFA's Guns and Butter program, an associate of ours. And in addition to the two-CD, Who Killed Kennedy and Why, we have a pamphlet for you that is not available anywhere. Not available in bookstores, not available on Amazon.com. It is only available for this WBAI fund drive, and that is Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, The Continuing Dynamic. It is the expose of the Robert Kennedy assassination. The combined premium, Who Killed Kennedy and Why, the two-CD lecture about the John F. Kennedy assassination, the dynamics and the political intrigue, that plus Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, The Continuing Dynamic, the pamphlet by Ralph Schoenman, available as our gift to you for your pledge to WBAI of $100. $100. Michael, will you remind everyone of the phone numbers to call? And then let's get on with the first track from the first CD.
Who Killed Kennedy and Why? Ralph Schoenman's riveting expose of how U.S. rulers devour their own was recorded in Los Angeles in 1992. At the time of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, Ralph Schoenman was executive director of the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation. In early 1964, he formed and directed the Who Killed Kennedy Committee in London with Bertrand Russell and other prominent figures. The committee uncovered explosive documents, including files from the Dallas DA's office that exposed the government cover-up. Ralph Schoenman collaborated for years with New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison in documenting the role of the CIA in the murder of Kennedy and testified with Dick Gregory before the Rockefeller Commission in 1975. He has lectured at over 100 universities in the United States, in addition to those in many countries, on the untold evidence and underlying political dynamics of the execution of John F. Kennedy and official murder in America.
I want to discuss with you tonight not only the mechanics of the execution of John Kennedy, not just the question of the plug uglies, the hired hands, the killers on demand that are at the disposal of the ruling class in the United States and have been for the past 200 years. But I want to discuss the context, the political context, the underlying dynamic of the execution of a head of state, which, after all, is a rather extreme mode for the ruling class to adopt. And it's going to be my purpose to locate the Kennedy brothers within the structure of power, and in the course of so doing, to discuss with you what would motivate people at the center of authority to remove one of their own. Because as you will see in the course of the talk tonight, I do not believe that it helps any of us to understand the nature of power and the workings of it, its murderous path, by resort to romanticizing, in retrospect, the victims when they are from the center of power themselves. The age of Camelot belongs to King Arthur, not to the 20th century. When we were in the process of looking at the Kennedy assassination in late 1963 in London, We were not amongst those who were the admirers of the Kennedy brothers, in or out of power or office. Indeed, the Kennedy brothers had been responsible for bringing the world to the brink of nuclear war on more than one occasion. In 1961, at the time of the Berlin crisis, Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense of John Kennedy, had declared in a speech that the United States would win a Third World War. Of course, there would be approximately 160 million American dead, 90% of Europe's population, but the U.S. would emerge victorious. And that speech was not a casual address. It was a formal presentation which was picked up at the time by Prime Minister Harold Macmillan in the course of mobilizing people in support of the confrontation that the ruling class was effecting in Berlin with the Soviet Union. Bertrand Russell gave a speech in Birmingham to the Youth Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and in that speech he said that Kennedy and Macmillan were worse than Hitler. He was pilloried for that. But he said, look, the Nazis visited upon Europe a genocidal program which was effectively the internalization within Europe of the colonial plan of several hundred years, replete with the ideology of Untermensch. But they did not carry through, nor did they indeed contemplate the extermination of hundreds of millions of people in an instant. So I, without elaborating at this point further about the extent to which the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation, our Committee of 100, our campaign for nuclear disarmament, our struggle against U.S. bases, our struggle against the nuclear weaponry itself, the missiles and the alliances, saw the Kennedy brothers as anything but the defenders of human interest. I want to give you some flavor of what it was that brought us into the arena of examining the assassination of Kennedy. In part, it had to do with the war in Vietnam. 1962, Bertrand Russell wrote a letter to the New York Times. And in that letter, we set forth the use by the United States Armed Forces in Indochina of bacteriological weapons, biochemical weapons in Indochina. And the New York Times attacked Russell editorially after publishing the letter, and they echoed a statement of the Secretary of State of John Kennedy that Bertrand Russell was spreading communist propaganda as he in his heart knew. So we sent a response to that to the New York Times in which the particular chemicals were specified, the villages in which they were used, the effect on individuals delineated, the properties of the chemicals set forth, the nerve gases that were in use, the gases that exploded the pupil of the eye. The New York Times ran that letter but excised five paragraphs with the particulars and then attacked Russell for lacking the evidence. And Bertie wrote a letter to the New York Times in which he said at that moment that he had never before in his long years of confrontational relations with the established media, he had never before had that particular experience. And John Oakes, the editorial page editor, said to Russell in a letter, do you mean to say that if you were to attack the Soviet Union with the same venom with which you attack U.S. policy, that Izvestia or Pravda would publish what you wrote? And Russell said, undoubtedly not, but they have never purported to publish what I say while excising the evidence and then attacking me for the lack of it. If the former would be suppression, the latter is conscious fraud. And then we asked the New York Times to allow us to publish the entirety of that exchange, which they refused, and so it was indeed published as a pamphlet in the United States by the Student Peace Union in 1962 called Bertrand Russell in the New York Times on Vietnam. John Kennedy, when he came into office, was obsessed with counter-revolution on the cheap, with Green Berets, with Rangers, with James Bond, who was his particular hero. With Phoenix programs, there were at that time officially 500 U.S. military personnel in Indochina. At the time of the Kennedy execution, there were not 16,000, but 25,000. And I'm going to return to that reality in the course of this talk. But after the Kennedy execution, when within 24 hours his putative assailant was gunned down, we knew we were dealing with a government hit. And it's instructive that after we started the Who Killed Kennedy Committee, the established press took on a tone which we had not experienced before. Manchester Guardian ran an editorial in which they said that I was the anti-American American with a pathological hatred for the country in which he was bred. They didn't say spawned. And at that conjuncture, the notion that Bertrand Russell was senile and that was manipulated became the leitmotif of virtually the entire bourgeois press, notably the New York Times. Sulzberger ran a column in which he said that we, like the Moors of old, we had propped up the cadaver of Russell on a horseback to send out to do battle, etc. And we took it to mean that the extent to which they were worried was measured by the venom of their attack. There were four official versions of the Kennedy assassination almost immediately after the murder in Dallas. Version number one had it that as the motorcade was proceeding down Houston Street towards the Texas School Depository Building, the assailant in the sniper's nest took aim and hit Kennedy in the throat and in the head, frontal shots. And the reason that they went forward almost instantly with frontal shots is that when Kennedy was taken to Parkland Memorial Hospital, the 12 doctors and surgeons who were working on him frantically gave a press conference afterwards in which they described in a very detailed press conference the attempts to perform a tracheotomy to relieve the strangling of Kennedy and to follow the course of the bullet that had hit him in the throat. And they diagrammed on a blackboard the nature of entry wounds and distinguished these from ragged and large exit wounds as opposed to the neat entry wound hole. So the initial version that you will find in all the established newspapers, TV, and proclamations in the immediate aftermath of the Kennedy assassination was that Kennedy was hit from the front. But they had a problem, and it was largely the problem presented by the amateur filmmaker, dress manufacturer Abraham Zapruder, whose home movie, 8mm, showed that the limousine was the other side of the Book Depository Building at the moment that the shots rang out. So then they came up with version number two. Version number two was that Kennedy had turned at the moment of impact to wave to the crowd, thereby exposing his throat and head to the sniper's nest. And they dutifully went forward with that, all the official spokespersons. But, of course, the problem did not go away because the Zapruder film is like a chronometer, 18.3 frames per second. You can tell precisely the moment at which the shots hit. And Kennedy was looking straight ahead and slightly to the right at the moment of impact, fatal shots. It's at that point that the doctors and surgeons at Parkland Memorial Hospital were taken into custody by the Federal Bureau of Investigation for an extended time and produced afterwards at a press conference, where essentially what they said was, we was wrong. What we thought were entrance wounds were exit wounds. The then correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Richard Dudman, not yet, like many of the journalists would become, not yet tamed, said, look, I sat through 2 hours of a press conference with medical detail and diagrams laying out the nature of the wounds and how you were performing the operation in which you described them unmistakably as entry wounds. What are you telling us? And the chief surgeon responded to that by saying, I have been informed that the lone assailant was stationed behind the president, and therefore they had to be exit wounds. But that was not the last of the official versions. Because in the course of attempting to produce evidence in support of the initial versions, they had come forward with too much too soon. And the Federal Bureau of Investigation had produced John Kennedy's shirt and jacket, which showed a hole at the third thoracic vertebrae, approximately 6 inches below the nape of the neck. And that was rather difficult to reconcile with the official story, to wit, that Kennedy had been struck in the back of the neck, exiting the throat, and in the back of the head. So version number four had it that Kennedy had a lousy tailor. You see, his shirt and jacket were riding up high, which was what accounted for the bullet hole, etc. A gunning down of a post office worker on his beat would have received more serious investigative attention than that which was accorded the nominal head of state. And that was evident to anyone with eyes to see at the time. And in the course of attempting to uncover the many follies and contradictions of the official press releases and the bombardment of data that we were subjected to, the Who Killed Kennedy Committee was fortunate enough to be sent a series of files that were liberated from the district attorney's office in Dallas. And those 19 exhibits were instructive. One of them contained the paraffin test, which the police had run on Lee Harvey Oswald. And as many of you may be aware, that a paraffin test will detect unmistakably the presence of nitrates, which are minute particles that are released upon the firing of a weapon. The presence of nitrates does not necessarily require that a weapon has been fired, because there are other explosives and other chemical materials that could produce the presence of nitrates. But the absence of nitrates is incompatible with the firing of a weapon, and there were no nitrates present on the cheek, arm, or hand of Lee Harvey Oswald, according to the official exhibit of the Dallas Police Department. The weapon, as you may recall, was trumpeted as an Italian Mannlicher Carcano 6.5 millimeter, which is an odd choice since there had been no live ammunition made for it since 1944. It didn't have a stable scope. The sight was wobbly. It was a bolt-action rifle. Mark Lane used to say that it was rumored that that's why the Italians had lost the Second World War. In fact, the weapon that had been found at the Book Depository building was found by a Dallas policeman named Seymour Weitzman, who had held it up and identified it, and the police file is very explicit. Weitzman held up the weapon and read off from the stock, Mauser, 7.6 millimeter, standard issue at the Daltex building, catty corner to the Book Depository building, from which, indeed, as you will see, shots were fired which hit John Kennedy. Seymour Weitzman, by the way, was a graduate engineer, and he owned a sporting goods shop. So the Warren Commission attempts to say that he wasn't familiar with weapons was a rather tertiary effort to cope with the disclosures that the Who Killed Kennedy Committee and others made about the file of the report of Seymour Weitzman. The 19 exhibits included the testimony of a woman named Helen Louise Markham, who the officialdom had put forward as having identified Oswald positively in the murder of J.D. Tippit, the Dallas cop who was shot down. In fact, Helen Louise Markham identified the assailant as short, stocky, and bushy-haired, and refused in the first hours of interrogation to make an identification of Lee Harvey Oswald. The woman was badgered for days, and since the people who were present at the killing of Tippit began to fall by the wayside, Warren Reynolds shot through the head, Domingo Benavides shot at, Helen Louise Markham later said, well, she's not so sure. It might have been Oswald. But the actual testimony of Helen Louise Markham when she was first interviewed was that the assailant that she saw was short, stocky, and bushy-haired, and she said this person was not involved. Domingo Benavides himself would not make an identification of Oswald, although the authorities at the time had gone forward to say that he had. And then there was the unfortunate fact that the All Points Bulletin that was released by Sheriff Decker, warning Lee Harvey Oswald in the matter of the murder of J.D. Tippit, was released at 12:45, and Tippit was shot at 1:51, which was pretty good detective work even in Dallas. So the basic elements of the assassination that were put forward by the Warren Commission and before it published its findings by its apologists couldn't stand up to the most elementary examination of the witness data, the ballistics evidence, the medical evidence, and so on. Who, in fact, then, was Lee Harvey Oswald? Who was his assailant, Jack Ruby? You're all aware, of course, that the government to this day maintains that Lee Harvey Oswald was a disturbed, lone, misfit, a Marxist who had defected to the Soviet Union and whose assassination of the president was a reflection of his ideological persuasions. But the Warren Commission itself had the data, notwithstanding the fact that they were dependent upon the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI for any of the investigative information that came their way. Nonetheless, an internal memorandum from its general counsel, J. Lee Rankin, reveals a Secret Service report, number 767, with the rather explosive information of the time that Alan Sweat, chief of the criminal division of the Dallas Sheriff's Office, had reported that Oswald was an FBI operative, an informant, that he was receiving $200 a month, that he was reporting to James Hostie, and that his FBI number was S-172. Moreover, the Secret Service report reveals that on Friday, January 24, 1964, a meeting was held between Chief Justice Earl Warren, J. Lee Rankin, Attorney General Wagner Carr, Texas, the District Attorney in Dallas, Henry Wade, and Attorney Leon Jaworski, who would later become better known through Watergate as the putative investigator of the Watergate break-in. They came to discuss what to do about the fact that the Central Intelligence Agency number of Lee Harvey Oswald had come to light, 110-669. Lee Harvey Oswald was an intelligence operative almost from the instant that he joined the Marine Corps. And that, in part, is because he comes from what we know to be an intelligence family, but more of that. Almost immediately, Oswald was assigned to Atsugi Air Force Base in Japan, where he had a crypto security clearance, and where, having been trained in electronics, he had responsibilities for the U-2 overflights of the Soviet Union and China. Oswald shows up again in Kaimoi and Matsu Islands on behalf of intelligence, military intelligence, at the time of the confrontation between the Kuomintang on Taiwan and the People's Republic of China over the status of those islands. And at the time, you may recall, the Eisenhower administration was threatening nuclear war if the Chinese were to take Kaimoi and Matsu by force or to attempt to repel forays by the forces of Chiang Kai-shek. Oswald was one of the intelligence operatives handling the electronics and communications for the Central Intelligence Agency at Kaimoi and Matsu. Indeed, he was performing that function in 1958 when the Central Intelligence Agency attempted to overthrow the government of Sukarno in Indonesia by sponsoring an uprising of Mohammed Hatta in the Celebes Islands at the time, Oswald, who was operating both out of Clark Air Force Base and later in the Celebes themselves, was functioning as a Central Intelligence Agency operative. So the Marxist Lee Harvey Oswald had a strange military career. He served with Marine Air Control squadrons in Japan and Taiwan. He was trained at El Toro in California in foreign languages, notably Russian. His mother, Marguerite, provided proof to the Warren Commission that her son was an intelligence agent, quote, doing special work as an agent of the government, unquote. His fellow Marine, Kerry Tornley, disclosed that Oswald had a higher than usual security clearance. He worked at the security files, the S&C files at El Toro. And while he was subscribing to Pravda, he was as well trafficking in the top secret security files at the Marine radar installations. Fellow Marine Nelson Delgado reported to commanding officers that Oswald, as a radar specialist, was alone allowed into the silent area, the war room, with access to crypto security clearance military information. When he was trained at Santa Ana, he maintained the security clearance, and he was assigned the training of enlisted men and officers who would qualify for intelligence assignments overseas, quote-unquote.
You've been listening to Who Killed Kennedy and Why, the historic lecture by Ralph Schoenman at UCLA that is part, only one part, of our Taking Aim Premium today. It's a two-CD, wonderfully edited by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako, CD set. Who Killed Kennedy and Why? And we also have, as part of our premium, Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, The Continuing Dynamic, a pamphlet, an important article written by Ralph about the Robert Kennedy assassination, June 5th, 1968. We're on the 37th anniversary, coming up on the 37th anniversary of the assassination of Senator Robert F. Kennedy, on the eve of his winning the California primary for the Democratic Party nomination, which would have ensured that he would have been the Democratic Party candidate for president in 1968, changing the course of America, these two assassinations, and in these times of official fictions and fabrication of information that has led to the invasion of Iraq and official fiction and fabrication of much of political life in America, we considered that going back and looking at the dynamics of the assassination of the head of state and a would-be head of state was appropriate for Taking Aim and the WBAI Fund Drive, $100, our gift to you, 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950, Who Killed Kennedy and Why, and Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, The Continuing Dynamic. Russ?
Yes, Maya, well, the continuity is clear because it's not only the methodology that we see transparent with respect to 9/11. But let me just refer here to a memorandum dated November 29, 1968, from J. Edgar Hoover, who was then the director of the FBI, and it was a top-secret memo to the State Department entitled Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, November 22, 1963, and it states that on November 23rd, while Oswald was in police custody for interrogation about his affiliation with agencies of the United States government, FBI Special Agent W.T. Forsythe and Captain William Edwards of the Defense Intelligence Agency briefed Mr. George Bush of the Central Intelligence Agency about problems related to the circumstances and disclosure of same of the assassination. Quote, a source with close connections to the intelligence community confirms that Bush worked for the agency from 1960 and his oil business was a cover for clandestine operations. Now, what's interesting about this central role that we are able to track of George Bush, and that's the father, in the Kennedy execution and the cover-up thereof, is that the CIA proprietorial company that was involved was Zapata Petroleum Midland, and Bush, George H.W. Poppy Bush, with his address cited, was in fact the controlling figure. Now, not only was the top secret code for the Bay of Pigs operation known as Operation Zapata, but two of the ships used in the Bay of Pigs were one called the Barbara and the other the Houston. And the role here of George Bush Sr. in the arrangements that the Central Intelligence Agency was running with respect to the invasion of Cuba and their determination to pay back the Kennedy brothers for their failure to provide U.S. ground cover for that operation translate into a central role for Bush Sr. in the Kennedy killing. And on top of that, brothers and sisters, the Zapata company was precisely that company that Osama bin Laden's family was investing in on a heavy basis while the intelligence agencies were running Osama bin Laden and family in Afghanistan, ultimately merging and morphing into the Carlyle Group. There is a direct link between the modalities of assassination of the Kennedy brothers and the events that surround 9/11 and the intelligence agency's role in both. This is the examination of those relationships and how power really operates, who rules America, the criminalization of the state. The data is here, the analysis is precise, and the connections are clearly drawn. And I think it's a very useful document and CD for our listeners. Please call 212-209-2950, not only to avail yourself of the information, but to support Taking Aim and the programming that we bring in our critique of the capitalist state, continuities of control, and what is, in a sense, murder incorporated at the level of governmental authority.
212-209-2950. We're coming to you today from Vallejo, California, and we're coming via headsets on the telephone line. Normally, we're in the KPFA studios with Michael Yoshida Engineering in Berkeley and Kathy Davis, Spider Engineering in New York, and we have clarity of sound. And that clarity of sound depends upon your contributions, 212-209, wonderful audio of Who Killed Kennedy and Why. And I'm going to give you a little tidbits, and Ralph will too, from the pamphlet of the RFK, the official murder and capitalist rule. We'll read to you little excerpts. We can't read the whole thing. It's a large pamphlet. And we decided that it was a good combination to look at the dynamics, the ongoing dynamics that are at play in both assassinations, and especially relevant today. 212-209-2950, our gift to you for your $100 premium, your gift, your contribution to your listener-sponsored radio station, the voice that enables you to get the important information 24/7. And if you saw the New York Times today about what the government is doing against with the Corporation of Public Broadcasting, with even the National Public Radio and the censorship that is being imposed, it is all the more important to have a station such as WBAI that enables programs like Taking Aim, which strip the veil of official fictions and bring the important information to you. 212-209-2950. One aspect of the Robert Kennedy assassination that's similar to the John F. Kennedy assassination is the issue of the magic bullet. Ralph?
Well, the magic bullet, Maya, refers to the bullet known as 399, which was the Warren Report's incredible attempt to reconcile the physical evidence with a shot that was fired from the rear. In order for them to allow for the shots that would be got off by a bolt-action rifle in the short space of time available to it, literally the seconds available for it, they had a bullet that was supposedly entering John Kennedy's shoulder and exiting his throat, pausing in midair, making a right turn of 2 feet, going through Governor John Connally's back, exiting his nipple, then pausing and entering, going down and entering the thickest bone in the body, his wrist, and exiting his wrist, and then lodging in his thigh and falling out as a pristine bullet, the magic bullet 399. And in the Robert Kennedy killing, it's a similar modality.
Right. As Ralph writes, Sirhan Sirhan was directly in front of Kennedy, and no single witness among the 77 who were merged placed Sirhan closer than 3 to 5 feet in front of Kennedy. The police, though, had to, in their official fiction that they created, as Ralph writes, the police effort to reduce the number of bullets actually fired in order to preclude a second assailant. The thesis is that one bullet entered a ceiling tile, ricocheted off the ceiling, and exited another ceiling tile, striking the floor and bouncing off the floor to enter the forehead of one of the wounded victims. As he goes on later to write, he says, as for the weapon of Sirhan Sirhan, it could hold at most 8 bullets. 5 bullets struck other people in front of him. 4 bullets, however, penetrated Kennedy from directly behind, one passing through the shoulder pad of his suit jacket and 2 entering his back, in addition to the fatal contact shot to the head. All were at a sharp upward angle, wholly incompatible with the position of Sirhan and the reach of his weapon. Ralph?
Well, yes, and of course the an interesting aspect of this, which we detail in the article, was the autopsy report by Thomas Noguchi, the coroner of Los Angeles County. And immediately after that autopsy report had been prepared, the FBI did what they did to the doctors at Parkland Memorial Hospital in regard to the John Kennedy killing. They got hold of the coroner, and they sequestered the autopsy report, and they threatened him not to release it to anybody. Noguchi was a man who'd been around the police department for a long number of years, and he knew exactly what was involved here, because the autopsy report was a devastating blow to the official fiction. What he did was he sequestered it, or kept copies of it, and he sent one to Jim Garrison, the district attorney in New Orleans. He sent one to Dick Gregory. He sent one to me. The autopsy report of Thomas Noguchi shows that Robert Kennedy was killed by a fatal headshot to the back of the head, as you indicate, Maya, that all the shots entered from the rear. The only person compatible with the trajectory of the shots was Eugene Thane Cesar, who was, in fact, the bodyguard assigned by the police department, who had his weapon drawn, which was an actual replica of the Ivor Johnson .22 caliber pistol that was being fired wildly by Sirhan Sirhan.
Well, before you go on, let's remind our listeners, 212-209-2950. And if you're new to Taking AIM, this is the type of programming that we bring to you week after week. We're in our 4th year now on WBAI with Taking AIM with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. Our premium today, Who Killed Kennedy and Why, as well as the pamphlet on the Robert Kennedy assassination, Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, The Continuing Dynamic, are available for your contribution to WBAI of $100, 212-209-2950. This is not only food for thought. This is for the healthy mind and body and soul to keep you going, because without analysis, without understanding, you cannot have power and control over your life, because you don't have the basis with which to take action and change the world. Ralph.
Los Angeles Police Department and the interesting group that was set up by the Central Intelligence Agency, as well as by the Los Angeles Police Department under its direction, which was called Special Unit Senator, the investigating unit, They destroy 2,400 photographs, negatives, and x-rays of vital evidence. They confiscated the door panels with the bullet holes and the embedded bullets, the ceiling tiles with bullet holes, and destroyed them. The then Assistant Chief of Police, Daryl Gates, acknowledged that even the examination reports and records of this evidence were destroyed. Not only was the evidence of the bullets in the door frames eliminated, but the police were photographed removing them. In 1969, the Los Angeles police had removed all the door frames and the center divider containing bullets and bullet holes. A reason for this, brothers and sisters, that 13 shots were fired, and Sirhan's weapon only holds 8 shots, and he was standing 5 feet in front of Robert Kennedy firing wildly. So obviously, from the most elementary examination of the evidence, a first-year law student would have had Sirhan out of that courtroom. In 1975, long after the police had physically destroyed the critical evidence, they staged an orchestrated raid on the pantry for the benefit of the print and electronic media. They confiscated anew the replacement center divider and door frames which the police themselves had installed after removing the originals to destroy the evidence. Based on this charade, the police then declared that no bullets from Sirhan's weapon had entered the panels and center dividers of the pantry in the Ambassador Hotel. So, they destroyed the original center divider and door frames. They replaced them with sanitized material. They then represented that the replacement material established an absence of the evidence. This performance rendered both the police and all of the media, which colluded in this deception, accessories after the fact in the murder of RFK, as Dick Gregory and I stated at the time to the Rockefeller Commission. Here it is, brothers and sisters. We lay it out for you in a very long and dynamic, I have to say it myself, and shocking demonstration of the fraud of the state at the level of the highest authority with respect to the execution of principal figures of the rulers themselves. That is what informs 9/11. That is what informs the permanent war agenda of the rulers. That is what informs our six-part series about creating the next pandemic, the weaponization of biological weapons to be used against the people of the United States. The assassinations are a clinical examination, a litmus test study of how power really operates at the highest levels of authority and its intent with respect to all of us. We ask you, therefore, support this programming. Keep this information coming. Keep this understanding about its meaning alive. Support Taking Aim. Call 212-209-2950 and equip yourself with the information, documentation, the evidence in your hands.
Ralph, 2,400 photographs, negatives, x-rays of the vital evidence, as we've been saying, and the doors, the bullets, all this destroyed. Yes, as you said, as I said, all of this destroyed by the LAPD and Special Unit Senator. All this evidence destroyed, but there was a problem. The investigator, Theodore Chirac, had the photographs of the police taking out the door frames, taking out the center dividers that contained the bullets and the bullet holes, and he showed them to you. He supplied you with these photographs. As well, Theodore Chirac had been writing. If it hadn't been for the persistence of investigators like Chirac, like Ralph, and like many others, this chapter of our history would have been closed, would have been signed, sealed, and delivered forever. It is so important to maintain access to WBAI, to the work that we do. Please get on your phone and call 212-209-2950. Think of what the world would be like if all this evidence had just been destroyed and no research had ever been done to uncover the real truth behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the assassination of Robert Kennedy, as well as the ongoing daily assault against each and every one of us.
Ted Chirac, as you indicate, Maya, was and is an indefatigable investigator despite all sorts of personal threats and what have you. We could go into those another time. But one of the things that Ted Chirac did, as you indicate, we're working together on this. He did a film, a documentary, in which he had actually got hold of an interview with Eugene Thayne Sesar, the mob-run intelligence operative assigned by the Central Intelligence Agency as the putative guard of Robert Kennedy. In this interview, Eugene Thayne Sesar, who was affiliated with the American Nazi Party, says on camera, when you have a nigger lover like Robert Kennedy, you take him out in one of two ways. Obviously, the person of choice to be assigned as his putative guard. In fact, the very instrument of the execution of Robert Kennedy. A panel of seven firearms experts established conclusively that there was no match between the critical bullet, Exhibit 47, that was removed from Kennedy's neck, and the alleged test bullet, which was supposedly fired through Sirhan's gun. When we looked at this, we found that the serial number of the gun that actually fired the bullets that were into a water recovery tank inside the LAPD crime lab was in reality a similar 22 caliber Ivor Johnson cadet revolver with a different serial number, H18602. The astonishing proof of this is evident in what we uncovered as court exhibit number 55. Therefore, the Sirhan weapon, although at all times available for examination and testing through court order, was in fact not tested. And what they did was they destroyed it and they substituted a weapon which, in fact, had no connection whatsoever to Sirhan and every connection to the authorities themselves. The only gun actually linked to the Robert F. Kennedy homicide was destroyed on orders from above, and to this day, the court records reveal that Sirhan was sentenced to death through a gun he never owned, never saw, and never used in his life. And that doesn't clinch it for the demonstration of the way power operates, and what we have here in the Robert Kennedy execution, nothing will.
212-209-2950. We are discussing today who killed Kennedy and why. That is the John F. Kennedy assassination. And as a special new premium not available anywhere else, the pamphlet, Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, The Continuing Dynamic. And this refers to Ralph's compilation and his own research on the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And this goes into not just the ballistics, but it goes into the politics of it, the cover-up, how it was affected with Special Unit Senator, the involvement of the LAPD and the CIA as Murder Incorporated, who were the players, hitmen, Eugene Thayne Sesar, and Manuel Pena, one of the prime investigators, their links to the mob. In fact, the Ambassador Hotel as part of the, as a mob-owned hotel, and what it means to have had the assassination take place in the Ambassador Hotel.
Yeah, the Ambassador was Mickey Cohen territory and intimately linked to the Los Angeles Police Department. But you indicate Special Unit Senator as the overriding body conducting all the interrogation of witnesses and the handling of evidence. Who were the people who were involved in this? Manuel Pena and Sergeant Enrique Hank Hernandez. It turns out that Manuel Pena, as Bill Turner, who has written extensively on this subject and investigated it, and a good friend of mine had indicated, the choice of Lieutenant Manuel Pena for the key slot in SUS was curious. Pena was a living legend. He had killed 11 suspects, more than any other officer in the history of the department. In Special Unit Senator, Los Angeles Police Chief Robert Houghton boasts Pena has connections with intelligence agencies in several countries. What we did not know at the time was that Pena and Hernandez had long-standing connections with the Central Intelligence Agency. The first clue about Pena came about when a faded newspaper article came to our attention. On November 13, 1967, 6 months before the RFK slaying, the San Fernando Valley Times reported Pena's formal nominal retirement from the LAPD. Quote, Pena has retired from the police force to advance his career. He has accepted a position with the Agency for International Development Office of the State Department. As a public safety officer, he will train and advise foreign police forces in investigative and administrative matters, and will be assigned to his post in a Latin American country. It was an open secret that the Office of Public Safety of the Agency for International Development was a cover for the CIA's clandestine program training national police and intelligence services in Southeast Asia and Latin America in death squad operations. 1968, California Chief Attorney General Charles A. O'Brien disclosed that the ultra-secret CIA unit was known to the insiders, quote, the department of dirty tricks, and its specialty was training foreign intelligence apparatus in the techniques of assassination, quote, unquote. These are the guys in charge of the investigation. These are the guys who placed the guards there for Robert Kennedy. These are the smoking gun instruments of the execution of Robert Kennedy, the details, the data, the documents, and the analysis in the pamphlet, Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, The Continuing Dynamic.
That and the 2CD, Who Killed Kennedy and Why, referring to the John F. Kennedy assassination, the classic presentation by Ralph Schoenman, as only Ralph can analyze, with not just the logistics and the ballistics, but also the politics. 212-209-2950. We're not in the studio. We are unaware if you're calling or not. We hope you are getting to your phone. We're coming up on the 5 o'clock hour where Taking Aim normally is situated week after week. As I said, we're into our fourth year of programming week. And who would have believed it? With the investigation of 9/11, with the analysis of the invasion of Iraq, even before the United States had done it, with our peace soup of deception, we were analyzing how the United States had had ongoing attacks against Iraq, not just with the devastating boycott, but actual military invasion and troops, troops secreted into Iraq. And then with the analysis of the invasion of Iraq, our programming week after week about the advent of martial law, the possibilities, and how the government is setting up the stages for martial law. All these and much more, such as our 6 weeks of programming on creating the next pandemic, this is available only on WBAI for you. 212-209-2950. Your gift to yourself, maintaining WBAI, Who Killed Kennedy and Why, and the pamphlet on the Robert Kennedy assassination for $100. Also, there are the memberships with WBAI and T-shirts, mugs, all of that available when you call 212-209-2950 and talk to the volunteers in the pledge room. Right now, our premium, 212-209-2950. Ralph?
The man who chose Cesar to guard Kennedy turns out to head of security of the Ambassador Hotel, William Gardner. He selected Thane Eugene Cesar, and he was involved with securing the security guard Elmer Boomhauer. These were people who had created a pamphlet, an orange and black pamphlet that was disclosed later, called Kill Kennedy. The Ambassador Hotel ownership was tied to mobster Mickey Cohen and the family of G. David Shine, who was the companion of Roy Cohen. Remember, Cohen and Shine were the instruments of Joseph McCarthy and rivals of Robert Kennedy and the McCarthy.
Well, Ralph, let's give the phone number out, because as you present all this interesting information, we want to give you tidbits for an excerpt, because you make your gift and you get your premium, then you can have in-depth all this material. 212-209-2950. Ralph is chafing at the bit to continue talking, and I'm not going to let him until he gives out this phone number another five times.
Brothers and sisters, we need you to support this work. We need you to support Taking Aim. And I think it's important as well that you have at your fingertips the documentation and the critique. It's pretty explosive, even today, and the connections between the executions, as I mentioned, of the Kennedy brothers and the ongoing events of 9/11 are not theoretical. They're direct. They're concrete. So is the phone number to call, 212-209-2950.
Well, that's one, Ralph. Four more. 212-209-2950. I will say it's not even today. It's especially today important for you to have the understanding of the workings of the henchmen of capitalism. 212-209-2950. We have 1 minute before 5 o'clock when we come up to Taking Aim. And at 5 o'clock, we're going to continue with playing excerpts from Who Killed Kennedy and Why, and then the two CD set, and then we're going to come back and discuss more about the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. That's something we haven't talked about yet on Taking Aim, and it's an extremely important issue, and Ralph is definitely the man to be making the presentation.
Well, Maya, the William Gardner figure who was selecting the executors of Robert Kennedy, the main investigator, the LAPD chief criminalist, Dwayne Wolfer, who was responsible for the fairy tale about the lone assassin being Sirhan Sirhan and the bullets all coming from his weapon, left the LAPD to work for Gardner and Eugene Thain Cesar's Ace Detective Agency. As this information began to surface, Gardner was amongst those who disappeared. And Eugene Thain Cesar had this to say about Security Chief Gardner: "Well, we've taken care of him. We'll never get another interview with him. He's disappeared." The operations director of the hotel was said to have committed suicide. All relevant files at the Ambassador Hotel were destroyed, and the operation of the Central Intelligence Agency and its mob hirelings went into high gear. You want the data? It's all here. The pamphlet is pretty shocking, brothers and sisters. Support this work, 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Another time, Maya. 212-209-2950.
Your contribution of $100 to WBAI, Who Killed Kennedy and Why, the two CD set of the amazing lecture by Ralph Schoenman, edited by Bonnie Faulkner and Yaro Mako. It's dynamic. It's riveting. There isn't a time even for a breath. It'll keep you on the edge of your seat. And the pamphlet, the not available anywhere else, Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, the Continuing Dynamic about the Robert Kennedy Assassination by Ralph Schoenman. As we approach the 37th anniversary, it was June 5th, 1968.
Well, the 37th anniversary, Maya, is coming up. This article and this data was put together actually on the 27th anniversary of the execution of Robert Kennedy. The data had been long time a part of our investigative work, but we tied it all together in this particular pamphlet, and we've added to it since. We want you to have it. Please support the work. Get the CD. Get the pamphlet. Equip yourselves, brothers and sisters, and support this programming. 212-209-2950.
And if you're just joining us, it's 5:02 in New York City. This is a special edition of Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen here on WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM on the web, available on the web at WBAI.org. This is the time, the usual time for Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. So we will start the program as we usually do, or I should say we'll continue the program, and with the theme song of Taking Aim.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, May 17th, 2005. Today we bring to you excerpts from our gift to you for your contribution of $100 to maintain WBAI, your listener-sponsored radio station, and that's Who Killed Kennedy and Why, which are the dynamics of the John F. Kennedy assassination, and a special new pamphlet, Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, The Continuing Dynamic, which is an article written by Ralph for Prevailing Winds magazine in 1996 on the 27th anniversary of the Robert Kennedy assassination. And he's been discussing in great detail some of the dynamics of the Robert Kennedy assassination, but there's no way on our program today that we can go into the compact and the voluminous information that is presented in this pamphlet. And we thought this is a great combo, the John F. Kennedy assassination, the details, and also the political analysis, and then to tie it in with the Robert Kennedy assassination
and
the details and the dynamics.
In particular, Maya, because as we disclosed that the Central Intelligence Agency was the instrumentality in the Kennedy killings, both brothers, and as we documented the plug uglies and hitmen who were mob contract killers working for the CIA, and as we disclosed the dynamics of the Robert Kennedy assassination in particular, one of the features which we delineate is the mind control program, MKUltra, of the Central Intelligence Agency, Operation Artichoke, and the actually grooming and wiping the mind clean as a slate of Sirhan for the execution of Robert Kennedy, chapter and verse. The Office of Naval Intelligence, the Central Intelligence Agency, the programming of the political assassins, the actual implementation of this program specific to the Robert Kennedy killing itself, documented without any mistake with the actual sources of the official inculpatory information and data and reports and documents.
Ralph, as you wrote, Dr. Spiegel, that's Herbert Spiegel, who helped analyze the case of Candy Jones, which he writes in detail in his book, The Control of Candy. It's written about in The Control of Candy Jones by Donald Bain, that was published in 1976. Dr. Herbert Spiegel had this to say about Sirhan Sirhan, quote, "It's very possible to distort and change somebody's mind through a number of hypnotic sessions. Can be described as brainwashing. The mind is cleared of its old emotions and values, which are replaced by implanting other suggestions. This is the technique used with Sirhan. From my research, I think Sirhan was subjected to hypnotic treatment," end quote.
Yes, actually, it's disclosed as well in the San Francisco Examiner on September 7, 1977, the CIA's MKUltra mind control program and the workings of Operation Artichoke, quote, "unlock Sirhan's mind," and Bill Turner and John Christian in their particular book on the subject discuss as well Dr. William Joseph Bryan Jr., who was the Central Intelligence Agency overseer of the agency's experimentation with mind control and behavior modification for the programming of assassins. Operation Mind Control of W.H. Boart examines the CIA Office of Naval Intelligence and other governmental agency programs undertaken for the conditioning of subjects to become political assassins. In 1975, the Sunday Times in London cited the U.S. Navy psychologist to acknowledge that the U.S. Navy intelligence had taken individuals from military prisons, conditioned them as political assassins, and placed them in United States embassies across the world. The particularized targeting of Sirhan and his deployment for this purpose is set forth in great detail in this article, as I mentioned, with chapter and verse. Brainwashing, an account of Dr. Ewan Cameron's protracted program of depatterning, which is now a documentation that has been cited in a number of places. Victor Marchetti and John Marks in the CIA and the Cult of Intelligence, as well in the search for the Manchurian candidate, the CIA and mind control, this is what they were doing. Quote, this is a CIA doctor operating under the color of authority. Dr. Ewan Cameron's protracted program of depatterning are defined as breaking up existing patterns of behavior by means of particularly intensive electroshocks combined with prolonged drug-induced sleep. Here was a psychiatrist willing, indeed eager, to wipe the human mind totally clean, creating such a state in which a man who knew too much would be made to forget and had long been a prime objective of both Artichoke and the MK Ultra programs was directed specifically to Sirhan. Apart from hypnosis, these government programs were carried out over decades, I'm quoting, on human subjects. In standard professional electric shock, doctors gave the subject a single dose of 110 volts lasting a fraction of a second once a day or every other day. By contrast, Cameron used a form 20 to 40 times more intense, three times daily, with the power turned up to 150 volts. The frequent screams that echoed through the hospital did not deter Cameron or his associates in their depatterning of their subjects. Martin Cannon, in his study, The Controllers, Mind Control, and Project MK Alter, puts into context what we have here. 7 years after the assassination of Robert Kennedy, a high-ranking U.S. intelligence officer who developed the psychological stress evaluator confirmed that Sirhan Sirhan and the psychiatric sessions and interviews were directed specifically to this objective.
Ralph is reading from the pamphlet Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, The Continuing Dynamic, which is part of our premium for this KPFA fund drive. The other section, Who Killed Kennedy and Why, the 2-CD compilation of lecture complete with the question and answer. And this combo is available for $100, your generous contribution to WBAI 212-209-2950. We're reading you only portions from the pamphlet and discussing this issue, and we are playing sections from Who Killed Kennedy and Why. Get those phones ringing, 212-209-2950. Get the phones ringing and the volunteers working in the pledge room, and we will go back to the CD.
Before we do, Maya, I just want to mention one thing. My associate, Martin Cannon, when he was examining the data pertaining to mind control and Project MKUltra, reached the following conclusion. He said all the powers of the Empire and the scientific establishment have been brought into an unholy alliance to invoke a specter, psychiatrist and spy, specialists and clandestine operators. We are in the presence of the development of the crypto-fascist state. And indeed, the executions of the Kennedy brothers, much as 9/11 itself, are playing out of that prepared scenario which we document here. Please support this work. Obtain this information. Obtain the pamphlet of the CD. 12209.
And keep those phones ringing, because remember, you get on the phone, you speak to the volunteer, you make your contribution, your pledge to WBAI, which is your station, and you can do this while you're listening, because these CDs will be in your home. You can listen to them over and over again, send them to your friends, your family, your colleagues. Keep them informed so that we can make change here that affects all our lives. 212-209-2950. Michael, let's go to the continue with Who Killed Kennedy and Why. We were in the Ralph was in the midst of explaining who really was Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald.
So it should be fairly obvious, as it was to us at the time, that Oswald's putative interest in Marxism was a cover. With 43 days left before he was to be discharged from the Marine Corps, he was granted a hardship discharge nominally to take care of his mother, who didn't need his care, either financial or other. And Oswald proceeded to Helsinki, supposedly to study at the University of Turku. But he didn't take a commercial flight. He was flown by military aircraft. He entered the Soviet Union and appeared in Moscow on October 16, 1959, proceeded to renounce his United States citizenship, declare his allegiance to the Soviet Union, and to declare as well that he would provide sensitive military information to the Soviet authorities. His immediate commanding officer in Marine Air Control Squadron 9, Lieutenant John Donovan, stated that Oswald had, quote, compromised all our secret radio frequencies, our call signs, our authentication codes. He had the security codes for every unit on the West Coast and the radar capability of every installation, which was pretty good work for a Marxist who had no access to these sources of information. Donovan said, quote, Oswald had access to the location of all bases on the West Coast, radio frequencies for all squadrons, all tactical call signs, the relative strength of all squadrons, the number and type of aircraft in squadrons, the commanding officers, the code for entering and exiting the air defense identification zone, the range of our radar and of surrounding units' radio and radar. He knew the MPS-16 height finder gear and the TPX-1, which is used to transfer radar and radio signals from base to base. So we are told that Oswald handed over this sensitive military information, but in the entire time that he was in the Soviet Union, he maintained his crypto security clearance. It was never removed. And indeed, he was in weekly contact with intelligence officers from the embassy, namely Richard Snyder, and a woman who has frequently been passed off as a journalist. She's always been assigned the job of reviewing books on the assassination by the New York Times. She has been a person who had spent a lot of time with Marguerite Oswald in the immediate aftermath of the assassination, and only recently was presented by Dan Rather and others as an authority on the assassination to explain why Oliver Stone was smoking opium. That woman is Priscilla Johnson. Oswald would write to former Secretary of the Navy, Governor John Connally of Texas, informing him that the United States government has never had any charges against me. I've always had the full sanction of the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Perhaps that's why Oswald's so-called defection was monitored by the Director of Naval Intelligence, by SINCPAC, by the Central Intelligence Agency, FBI, and particularly by CAS, the CIA agency in Japan, in charge of U-2 spy operations. And perhaps that's why Gary Powers was of the view that when his U-2 plane was shot down over the Soviet Union, that he was in fact shopped, that military intelligence intended that the U-2 flight would be shot down, and as you may be aware, the shooting down of Gary Powers and his U-2 was the basis for the canceling of the summit meeting between Eisenhower and Khrushchev at the time. It was only when U-2 flights became otiose because of overhead spying through satellites that Oswald decided that he wanted to come home. And he shows up at the U.S. Embassy, and he says, I changed my mind. And so, being generous by nature, the United States State Department financed his return and that of his wife. And when he arrived in the United States, he wasn't met by any of the intelligence agencies, no. He wasn't debriefed, let alone arrested. We're told that he was met by a man named Spas T. Rakin of the Traveler's Aid Society. Spas T. Rakin was also the Secretary General of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Nations, Incorporated, the Director of the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, which worked with the Central Committee of the Kuomintang in Taiwan and with the Office of Hitler's Intelligence Network, the Abwehr, which had functioned in Riga and Lisbon from 1939 to 1945. Spas T. Rakin was also associated with an organization called Centro Mundial Comercial and the Permanent Industrial Expositions, Permindex, of L.M. Bloomfield, of Division 5 of the FBI, which was functioning in Montreal, and which we were coming in contact with through our work with investigative reporters in Paesi Sera, Giorgio Fanti, who, after months of work, were able to document the role of the Centro Mundial Comercial in organizing a military coup in Greece, of planning the same in Italy, and of funding and of organizing attempts on the life of Charles de Gaulle, which were in conjunction with the organization of the secret army of Jacques Soustelle, the right-wing and frequently fascist group that had opposed the neo-colonial resolution of the Algerian Revolution, which the mainstream of the French ruling class spoken for by Charles de Gaulle had concluded they had to pursue. We'll come back to the attempts to assassinate Charles de Gaulle and the role of Spasti Rakin and of others. Oswald would soon be pretending to be a supporter of Fidel and a spokesperson for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Because, you see, Spasti Rakin delivered him to another interesting character, Count Sergei George de Morenschild. De Morenschild had been a member of OSS, the U.S. intelligence agency, which was the antecedent organization preceding the Central Intelligence Agency. De Morenschild had also worked for the Sûreté and for Hitler's Abwehr. Indeed, he was arrested in Arkansas in 1943 and accused of spying on U.S. military installations for Hitler's North American intelligence agencies. But he was released when he had a letter on him from Nelson Rockefeller, which vouchsafed for his intent. It was George de Morenschild who brought Lee Harvey Oswald to Dallas and who introduced him immediately to the intelligence community that was centered in the direction of General Dynamics. But Oswald, when he was in New Orleans and a spokesperson for the One Person Fair Play for Cuba Committee, had an office which many of you are aware of, became famous through the investigation of Jim Garrison. The office for Oswald's committee was 544 Camp Street in New Orleans. 544 Camp Street was also the office of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, which had been established by E. Howard Hunt, for the Student Revolutionary Directorate of Carlos Bringuier, which had been also set up with E. Howard Hunt, and the offices were rented by a man named Guy Bannister, who the Warren Commissioner said was a private detective. Guy Bannister was the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation's office in Chicago. He was an officer of Naval Intelligence. He had organized with E. Howard Hunt the overthrow of the Arbenz regime in Guatemala in 1954. And with Bringuier and E. Howard Hunt and Sergio Arcacha Smith from 544 Camp Street, the nominal office of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, the Cuban Revolutionary Council operated. Well, what was the Cuban Revolutionary Council? At the time that the United States was preparing to invade Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, the operational commander for the Bay of Pigs was Major General Charles Cabell, the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who was, of course, in the National Security Council, answerable to his political supervisor, Richard Nixon, as vice president, in what was known at the time as Operation 40. The planned invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs had a political officer, namely E. Howard Hunt, and it was in that context that the Cuban Revolutionary Council was established as the shadow government to be after the successful invasion of Cuba and or assassination of Fidel Castro. E. Howard Hunt, Carlos Bringuier, Guy Bannister, and Spasti Rakin had been one of the coordinates with Bringuier's Student Revolutionary Directorate. All the Cuban groups with whom Oswald would associate in Dallas and New Orleans were, in fact, Central Intelligence Agency-sponsored organization. And when he was in Dallas, he was introduced by George de Morenschild to the Shah of Iran, to Nelson Rockefeller, to the former intelligence director for OSS, and to French intelligence operatives, and to Baron Meidel. Baron Meidel was a top Abwehr official in North America for Hitler, and indeed it was the same Abwehr with which the organizations of Spassky Rakin and of L.M. Bloomfield and of Permindex and Centre Mondial Commercial were linked. There were others. Igor Voshinin was a member of a number of white Russian anti-communist organizations who became inseparable from Lee Harvey Oswald in Dallas. George Bowie, who worked for the major defense contractor Texas Instruments as a corporate executive. Bowie and Voshinin were also members and founders of the Greek Orthodox Church, which had been, in fact, established with another interesting character, namely Frank Fiorini or Frank Sturgis, as a front for the Central Intelligence Agency. And the man with whom the lone Marxist Oswald dined and socialized most often was Max Clark, formerly of the FBI and director of security for the Convair Division of General Dynamics, working on top secret military contracts and with intimate ties to intelligence. Clark's wife had been a member of a number of neo-Nazi organizations for many years. Others of Oswald's circle in Dallas: Paul Dimitrik, Texas Instruments; Ilya Mamontov, a far rightist who contacted Marina 5 hours after the assassination; Michael and Ruth Payne, indeed, with whom Oswald was staying, of Bell Helicopter; Jack Crittenden, a petroleum engineer like de Morenschild, with Army Intelligence, and also vice president of a strange entity called the Empire Trust Corporation, which maintained a private Central Intelligence Agency around the world. And his private CIA was guarding investments in Cuba and Guatemala for such as General Dynamics. And then there was Paul Rygorodsky. His role is particularly intriguing. Rygorodsky had fought against the Bolsheviks, was a representative to NATO, and was a member of the board of directors of the Tolstoy Foundation. Tolstoy Foundation was funded by the Central Intelligence Agency. So wherever you touch Lee Harvey Oswald, you come up with intelligence. Let's look at some of the other people who were using the front of the Tolstoy Foundation. Jean de Menil of Schlumberger Munitions, which Rygorodsky described as a worldwide organization that deals in every country in the world. You know what I'm trying to say. It was Schlumberger Munitions which had supplied the OAS and Jacques Soustelle and the attempts to assassinate and overthrow Charles de Gaulle as president of France. Now, in particular, the efforts to assassinate Charles de Gaulle, which the Who Killed Kennedy Committee was involved in investigating, and which were part and parcel of the uncovering of the role of Centre Mondial Commercial and of Permindex, disclosed that there had been a particular funding of those assassination attempts. And the funding was authored by a character named Guy Bannister, who dispatched his own attorney to deliver the funds in hand, French intelligence services confirming this. In fact, de Gaulle denounced Permindex and the Centre Mondial Commercial as Central Intelligence Agency proprietary organizations, and the investigations in Italy led to the expulsion of Clay Shaw as persona non grata. The CMC was founded in Montreal in 1958. Let's look at some of the directors. Former Hungarian Prime Minister Ferenc Nagy, a member also of the World Anti-Communist League. Giuseppe Spadafora, a member of Mussolini's cabinet and a relative of Jean-Marc Schach, the former finance minister of Adolf Hitler. L.M. Bloomfield, former officer of the Office of Strategic Services and a ranking officer of the little-known Division 5 of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and a confidant of J. Edgar Hoover. A director as well of the Defense Industrial Securities Organization, along with Clay Shaw. Clay Shaw had also been in the OSS. Clay Shaw's ranking in the OSS was such that he was assigned to the headquarters, the military headquarters of Winston Churchill. And shortly after World War II, Clay Shaw set up the World Trade Mart, which was later changed to the International Trade Mart in New Orleans. The trade activity of Shaw's organization included facilitating the banking of Meyer Lansky and his holdings in the Bahamas and in Batista's Cuba. It was part of the network of the World Trade Center Association, which encompassed over 50 World Trade Marts. The Hong Kong World Trade Center, by the way, is a satellite computer clearinghouse for the International Drug Cartel, a transnational tracking system for drug trade routes, carriers, inventories, and rates, and one of the points of convergence of the drug empire, of the mafia, and of the Central Intelligence Agency. These were the funding sources for the attempts to assassinate Charles de Gaulle, and these were the command operations for the Cuban Revolutionary Council and for the Student Directorate at 544 Camp Street in New Orleans. Who were some of the others who were operating out of 544 Camp Street? David Ferry, a Central Intelligence Agency pilot, and a pilot for Carlos Marcello of the mob. A man named Jack Ruby. Carlos Bringier, Ernesto Rodriguez, Ores Pena, and Ronald Kerr, all of the Cuban Revolutionary Council of E. Howard Hunt. And one of the people, oddly enough, who had visited and spent time with them was none other than Madame Nodin Nu, whose brother would be assassinated in Saigon shortly before the assassination of John Kennedy. When Oswald was in New Orleans, he was given a job at the Riley Coffee Company. The man who hired him at the Riley Coffee Company, Alfred Claude, was also a director of Chrysler Aerospace in the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. His immediate superior, Emmett Barbee, and his fellow worker, John D. Brannion, began work at the United States Government Space Center at the same time. This was the pattern of the people who worked at Riley Coffee. And as Jim Garrison liked to say, either Riley Coffee was involved in a fiendishly clever effort to sell coffee to men of the highly sensitive aerospace program, or we are once again in the presence of intelligence cover operations like the Travelers Aid Society and the Tolstoy Foundation and the emigre committees, which are the safe houses for the intelligence operations of the United States government. Jack Ruby used to be known as a kid as Sparky. He was even apparently in the Young Communist League as a youngster. Growing up in the slums of Chicago, however, he migrated very quickly to the mob. And we were told, of course, by the Warren Commission that there was no connection between Jack Ruby and not just organized crime, but anything to do with crime control of trade unions. Of course, Jack Ruby was the secretary of the Iron and Waste Handlers Local in Chicago and was involved in the murder of Leon Cook, its secretary general, in 1939, which was on the front page of the Chicago Tribune at the time, when the mob moved in on the Teamsters and took control of the Iron and Waste Handlers Local. Ruby surfaces again in an interesting way when it turns out that he was informing not just for J. Edgar Hoover, but when he was a valuable asset and witness for the House Un-American Activities Committee, notably a young congressman named Richard Nixon. because Ruby was pointing out the role of militants and so-called subversives in the trade union movement to the House Un-American Activities Committee and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And when Ruby is in Dallas, once again, he continues to work for J. Edgar Hoover, and he does for the mob. And in the period when the Batista regime was beginning to crumble and the July 26 movement is unfolding in Cuba, and the Central Intelligence Agency decides to hedge its bets, it organizes gun running to Fidel and to the July 26. And the principal gun runners were a man named Frank Fiorini and Jack Ruby. Frank Fiorini, who we know as Frank Sturgis, was so successful in his gun running that he was made the head of Air Force Intelligence of the new revolutionary government after the fall of Batista, and was put in charge of gaming and gambling in Havana. The man who Frank Sturgis brought in to control two of the clubs that he was running in the early days of revolutionary Cuba was none other than Jack Ruby. Jack Ruby, Louis McWillie, these were the clubs of Santo Traficante and of Meyer Lansky, the Rivera, the Tropicana. It was only when the Cuban Revolution moved left that these intelligence operatives of the U.S. government moved out, and they formed Alpha 66. They formed the Student Revolutionary Directorate, and E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis, who had collaborated together for years, come together as well in the Cuban Revolutionary Council, whose headquarters are in Miami and in New Orleans at 544 Camp Street. Whenever Jim Garrison looked into Oswald, all he could find was government. And when he found that 544 Camp Street was the locale, he knew that he was dealing with a government operation from start to finish. I'm going to abbreviate this at this point. There's a great deal more data on the relationships of the players between the Cabell brothers, Major General Charles Cabell, the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and the command officer at the Bay of Pigs fired by Kennedy, his brother Earl Cabell, the mayor of Dallas, their father, the mayor and sheriff of Dallas before them, the grandfather, the sheriff of Dallas before them, Dallas Cabell territory, the fact that John Kennedy was lunching at the International Trade Mart in Dallas of Clay Shaw, which had considerable bearing on the determination of the motorcade route. He was killed shortly before arriving at the Dallas International Trade Mart. The relationship of the Watergate burglars, Eugenio Martinez, Virginio Gonzalez, Bernard Barker, Frank Sturgis, E. Howard Hunt, to the assassination of John Kennedy, to the organization of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, to the Alpha 66 of Frank Sturgis. The fact that Eugenio Martinez was the vice president of Keyes Realty, and Keyes Realty was the organization or the instrument which purchased the Miami White House for Richard Nixon.
You are listening to an excerpt of Who Killed Kennedy and Why, the classic lecture by Ralph Schoenman. It is a 2-CD set, and it is part of the premium we're offering today for the WBAI Fund Drive. The other part is on the Robert Kennedy assassination, and that's a pamphlet, Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, the Continuing Dynamic. These important this compilation, the 2-CD set, the pamphlet, are available for your contribution to WBAI of $100. And it's our gift to you for supporting Taking Aim and WBAI. 212-209-2950. The pamphlet is available nowhere else. We're preparing it just for this fund drive. 212-209-2950. Many of you have supported WBAI in the past with Who Killed Kennedy and Why, and now is a good time to get a copy for your friends, your family, and your colleagues. 212-209-2950. Who Killed Kennedy and Why? As you can hear, you're not going to hear documentation like this and putting it together with the political analysis anywhere else. Michael, do you have a list of some of the people who've been supporting Taking Aim? We want to take this opportunity to thank so many people that helped bring Taking Aim to the air. Mark Bilk, who maintains our website at www.takingaim.info, and Pamela Summers, who helped create it and maintained it for so long. Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako of KPFA's Guns and Butter, which rebroadcasts and also edits our Taking Aim program when they appear on KPFA, and Bonnie works with us very closely. That's Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako of KPFA's Guns and Butter. And Michael Yoshida, the chief engineer at KPFA. Kathy Davis, the public affairs director at WBAI, and Spider, the engineer who helped bring Taking Aim to you via our ISDN connection when we recorded each week. And Michael G. Haskins, the wonderful announcer that WBAI is so fortunate to have and you get to hear on weekdays.
Weekday afternoons. Yes, thank you, Maya. And first of all, I'd like to thank the volunteers, as I know you and Ralph want to thank them very much as well, who are taking pledges right now at 212-209-2950. Thank you, Nia. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you, Caesar, and thank you, Josh. They're just that's just four random names of some of the people who are in the back taking phone pledges right now at that number. And if you'd like to become, if you'd like to come down to the radio station and help answer phones, please do. We're located at 120 Wall Street. That's WBAI Radio, 120 Wall Street. We're located on the 10th floor. And you need to bring a piece of photo identification to gain entry into the building. Now, Maya, you asked if any people that called wanted to be thanked on the air, and in fact I do have a stack of a few people who would like to be thanked. Cecil Silveries, I think it's in Spring Valley. Thank you very much, Cecil. Sorry if I mispronounced your name. Fabio Garcia from Port Chester, New York. Thank you, Fabio. Biles Offrey from Jersey City. Thank you very much. Raymond Costanti from Manalapan, New Jersey. Thank you very much, Raymond. John Bellardi from Carmel, New York. Thank you very much, John. John Davis from the Bronx. Tomas Dugas from the Bronx. Thank you very much, Tomas. James Wilkinson from Paterson, New Jersey. Ronald Phillips from New York, New York. Anthony Gonzalez from New York, New York. Frederick Kofter from New York City. Joe Breda from Miller Place, New York. And we have another caller from Brooklyn, New York, Lawrence Ramos. All calling in, all getting the CDs, the two CD set, Who Killed Kennedy and Why, made to you. Made available to you by Taking Aim, Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, as well as in that package, The Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, The Continuing Dynamic.
We want to thank all of you. And
thank you very much for your support. Go
Michael,
ahead, Maya.
Mm-hmm. Michael, one thing that's so clear from all of people who are calling in for this premium is the range that WBAI reaches, the incredible range in the tri-state area of New York. Another thing I noticed is, come on, women, let's call 212-209-2950. It seems all the names we were thanking were men, and I know women listen to Taking Aim. We get so many emails and telephone calls from women throughout the area, and this is a very important premium that we prepared for you, the Who Killed Kennedy and Why lecture and the dynamics of the Robert Kennedy assassination. One of the things we wanted to discuss in the remaining minutes, as Ralph had outlined in Who Killed Kennedy and Why, about who was Lee Harvey Oswald, who is, he's still alive, Sirhan Sirhan. Ralph?
Sirhan Sirhan, as we have documented in this pamphlet, was long associated with the mob and at the Santa Anita racetrack and with Desi Arnaz. These were fronting for Mickey Cohen. It ties as well to the specifics of the assignment of the Ace Guard Service, which was hired by Gardner, as we indicated, and for whom Eugene Thayne Cesar, who was holding the weapon that executed Robert Kennedy. This was all an involvement with Mickey Cohen's gambling operations. The Ace Guard Service and the U.S. National Bank of San Diego were established by the New York Times and by David Shine in his contract on America's laundering operations for organized crime. Cesar had been arrested in Tijuana performing jobs for John the Candyman Alicio, who was a director of the conglomerate controlling the U.S. National Bank. Cesar's ties to John the Candyman Alicio were facilitated through the good offices of none other than Roy Cohen. And involved with Alicio were Thomas Tommy Gunn Riccardi, Joe Fish Fischetti.
Did we lose Ralph?
You may have lost Ralph.
Okay.
Then you need to carry on, Maya, until
Ralph,
you can connect back with Ralph. There's nothing I can do on this end. But to encourage the listeners to call 212-209-2950. We have five calls on the line. I hear you fine, Maya, but I just brought you down until you get Ralph back online, and that's something that your listeners don't need to hear. All right. Go right ahead, Maya.
As Ralph writes, there's a book called Mafia Kingfish, Carlos Marcello and the Assassination of John F. Kennedy by John H. Davis. And he exposed that Sirhan had been working as an exercise boy at the mob-controlled Santa Anita racetrack, as Ralph mentioned before. And while there, he had befriended a horse trainer, Frank Donnarumas, who eventually got him his job as a groom at a horse breeding ranch in Corona, belonging in part to the mob-controlled entertainer and Cuban exile leader, Desi Arnaz, who, as Ralph mentioned, counted Mickey Cohen among his circle of acquaintances. Now, Sirhan kept the diary, and he repeatedly referred to Donnarumas as a good friend who made him happy by paying him sums of money for various unspecified jobs. The true name of Donnarumas was Henry R. Ramostella, and he had a long rap sheet that was acquired in New York and Miami. So the connections of Sirhan Sirhan as a patsy and a setup in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy are extensive and are detailed in this pamphlet by Ralph, Official Murder and Capitalist Rule in America, The Continuing Dynamic. I'm going to turn my headset over to I just figured out what happened. And now, Ralph, you should be on the air.
Well, I wanted to indicate, Maya, thank you for...
Do you hear him?
Yeah, we heard
okay.
him just fine.
Okay.
Involved, we were talking about the Candyman, John the Candyman Alessio. He's involved with Thomas Tommy Gunn Riccardi and Joe Fish Fischetti. And what's important about that is that Riccardi was identified by witnesses at the scene of the kitchen pantry barking orders to Cesar and the other ace security guards, kill him, kill him. That testimony was suppressed by the SUS people, Manuel Pena and Hank Hernandez. Indeed, those witnesses who gave that testimony were intimidated and threatened with death if they repeated what they had witnessed. Indeed, Eugene Thane César had strong links not only to this group but to Mickey Cohen and, as I mentioned, John Alessio. And indeed, Alessio would be sentenced to federal prison for skimming millions from the San Diego racetrack revenues. Roy Cohn would acknowledge, quote, the desire of John Mitchell, who would become Nixon's attorney general, to remove Robert Kennedy. Mickey Cohen, interestingly enough, had led the mob financing of Richard Nixon's entry into politics. All of Nixon's congressional campaigns in the 1940s and 50s were financed by organized crime. Cohen contributed $51,000 to Nixon in 1946, $75,000 from the Las Vegas mob men through Cohen for his senatorial campaign in 1950. So what we have here, indeed, is a direct link between the intelligence agencies and their contract killers in the mob. The mob support for Nixon in 1968 for the presidency included Alan Dorfman, the Teamsters' financial consultant in Chicago, and I have evidence, documents of the FBI discussing Dorfman's threats to Robert Kennedy, his ties to Jack Ruby, and as I mentioned in the Who Killed Kennedy and Why talk, Ruby's role in the murder of Leon Cook, president of the Scrap Iron and Waste Handlers Local in Chicago. This association of contract killers, plug uglies, and thugs, the mob relationship to the Central Intelligence Agency is a primary instrument of enforcement and what we call the criminalization of the state that continues to this very minute. That's what 9/11 is about, brothers and sisters. That's what the enforcement arm of capitalism is essentially about. It's targeting the people of the United States. It's eliminating any semblance of challenge to this kind of rule. And even within their own, they have fallings out over divisions of the spoils. We like to analogize the Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy executions to the murder or the murder of Julius Caesar. It isn't the crucifixion, brothers and sisters. The murder of Malcolm X and the Martin Luther King correspond to that. The elimination of leaders of the mass as opposed to fallings out amongst the rulers themselves. But the dynamics of those fallings out expose the workings of the state. They demonstrate what has happened under our capitalist-controlled state apparatus in this society. And they enable us to see clearly that we are pitted against those in power for our very survival. That's what this programming has all been about with Taking Aim. That's why we urge you, please, support this work. Get this data. It's meticulously documented. The analysis is there. It arms us for moving forward. Please call 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Maya?
It's Who Killed Kennedy and Why? And Official Murder and Capitalist Rule, the Continuing Dynamic, a pamphlet that we're preparing based upon an article that Ralph wrote in 1996, as timely today as it was then, describing the dynamics of the June 5th, 1968 assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. On the eve when he won the California primary, which would have meant he would have tied up the Democratic nomination for president. And we were talking before about who the people are involved in these assassinations, how Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, are not the people who actually were the shooters. And this is very important because people are set up. They're patsies. But the real and the official fiction maintains Lee Harvey Oswald and Sirhan as the shooters. And this is important for the maintenance of official fiction and to prevent us from understanding the true dynamics of the permanent war state.
Well, just consider that Sirhan Sirhan was portrayed as a Palestinian bitter over Robert Kennedy's support of Israel. In other words, the assassination is attributed to a lone Palestinian who takes his vengeance on Robert Kennedy. Lee Harvey Oswald, we were told, was a Fidelista, a lone Marxist, and indeed supported by the KGB and by Cuban intelligence in the assassination of John Kennedy to create precisely the conditions for a mass hysteria that would sanction the immediate invasion of Cuba. the analogies to the false flag operations of 9/11, in which the demonized figure of Osama bin Laden is held out for us to focus upon as the instrumentality of this terror wave against the American people, is very clear.
Osama bin Laden, who had been incorporated in the United States intelligence, the CIA, and also British intelligence role in Afghanistan against the government of Afghanistan at the time. And the Mujahideen at the time were considered liberation fighters by the CIA and British intelligence. They armed them, they funded them, they assisted them in their training, they provided all their equipment, and this is Osama bin Laden, who later on was demonized by U.S. rulers.
Which is their habit and their pattern. They first use them, then they abuse them, and then they deploy them. But these figures have their groups that are essentially intelligence agency fronts. They're totally penetrated, they're totally controlled. And even when the figures who are demonized have no relation to the events in question, those who have been involved in running them, in permeating their groups and in controlling them, carry out the operation in their name, and then they hold out these figures for us to focus upon. And that is the dynamic that we expose in the Kennedy killing, the Robert Kennedy assassination, and indeed, that is in fact the nature and the workings of the Murder Incorporated, which is the capitalist state today. This documentation connects the dots, brothers. That's what the CD does, and that's what the pamphlet does, and we urge you to support it. We encourage you to call 212-209-2950, support WBAI, keep free speech radio alive, keep this cutting-edge radical programming that is so intense with information and with precision and with documentation, so that we are armed with knowledge and that we can act in our own interests. That's what this programming is about, and we urge you to support it.
It is both the specifics of the assassination which are of interest, as well as the fact that these assassinations elucidate what Ralph does is elucidate within the context of these assassinations the dynamic and the structure of power. And when you understand this analysis, you will be able to understand so much that happens today, whether it is the attack against Social Security, the attack against our health care, what the dynamics of what is taking place in the pharmaceutical industry, in the with housing across the city.
Well, Ralph and Maya, we're just about out of time. Do you have any closing comments or
yes.
way that people can get in touch with you if they'd like to, because we're up against the clock right now?
Let me do one quick thing before we do that. I want to quote from Allard Lowenstein, the former congressperson who joined the investigation for the murder of Robert Kennedy. He wrote in the Saturday Review on February 2, 1977, James Hoffa did not vanish after a rendezvous with James Earl Ray acting alone. Loose nuts do not do in the Yablonskis. New editions of Lee Harvey Oswald or Sirhan Sirhan do not murder Sam Giancana in the basement of his home after 24-hour guard by the FBI. It's time to accept the fact that the question is not whether groups with such power exist, but how they use their power and who their allies are in and out of government. What can be done to protect democratic processes against these forces that operate out of sight and beyond the limits of the law? After writing these words, Alec Lowenstein was killed at the hands of a lone assassin, brothers and sisters. Contact us at www.takingaim.info to support the program.
That's our website for our archives and various articles. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's PACBELL.net or takingaim@wbai.org.